Good morning, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the chips in the PC. It is Sunday, the 2nd of November, Anno Domini 2008, and you lucky people. You're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Chris Reich.
And we're going to be bringing you news, views, stuff you can use, things you can lose, a couple of things you can choose. And speaking of choose, before we get to anything else, we're recording this on the 2nd. If you hear it before the 4th, you get your butt out there and you vote. I'm not going to tell you who to vote for because it's more important to me that you vote than you vote for a particular candidate. Get out and vote. Exercise your franchise as an American citizen and vote. If you don't participate, you can't complain.
Already voted, Nick.
Good for you.
You know, the only thing that upsets
vote early,
me
vote
about,
often?
About the voting, though, whatever I wish they'd still go back to, just like everything else, this electoral college, it still doesn't make any sense to me. When our forefathers started up, you know, the voting process and everything else, it was one person, one vote.
I can explain this.
Still should be,
but it's a computer show.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, but no.
Well,
I mean,
tie that into electronic voting machines and how bad they are.
Yeah, and they are.
I mean, you know, it still should be. Yeah, we could do a whole nother show.
Maybe
is there
should.
Anybody who trusts?
Well, I'm sorry.
Bottom line is, no. Like Nick said, is you know the key thing is just get out there and vote. You know, sitting there. Oh, well, you know, he's going to win or this person's going to win. It doesn't really make any difference. Well, by you not going out. There's one other vote that other person didn't get.
Right.
So, you know.
The election was decided last time by, what, 184 votes or some silly number?
Yeah.
Get out and vote.
Have you seen the flash videos flying around? McCain wins by one vote, and it's because you didn't vote, and it's personalized with your name in it.
Nice.
They've got news reporters that say your name. They've got newspaper headlines flash up with
nice.
Your name in it.
Nice. I like
pretty
it.
Cool.
That is sweet.
I like it a lot.
I haven't
right.
seen any the other way, though. So.
Oh, the best one? No, I heard the story, and it was down in North Carolina. This guy had McCain signs out on his front lawn. And they kept getting ripped off, and there was Obama signs being put out there. So I thought, well, I'm going to get even. I'm not going to get mad. I'm going to get evening. One evening, he went out and put up the new McCain sign and electrified it. So I guess this 9-year-old kid is in the hospital due to burns, zapping, because he was pulling down the McCain signs and putting up Obama. Needless to say, the owner isn't going to be charged, but they're still waiting to see if he's going to press any charges against the kid for trespassing.
Neither the cast of Soundbites nor the management or staff of WHEM condone electrocuting 9-year-old children.
No, but it was all a right, good idea to get back though at somebody.
Thank you for clarifying that.
We do not condone any of that.
Well,
all opinions expressed are those of Dave Enright and are not those of the staff and management of WHAM.
Although
the host of Soundbites or any right-thinking human being.
I heard a story sort of like that where a guy was tired of getting his warehouse got broken to all the time, so he finally booby-trapped it and put big signs up, you know, for the thieves to stay away. It's booby-trapped. Well, there was a fire. And the fire department stayed away because it was booby-trapped. Burned to the ground, lost everything.
Yeah.
All right, speaking of voting, you get to vote in this week's poll, which is inspired by a new news story. A Harvard law professor has opened a new front in the battle between the Recording Industry Association of America, the RIAA, and alleged music pirates by challenging the constitutionality of a statute being used by the industry group to bring lawsuits against alleged copyright violators. The case involves an individual named Joe Tenenbaum, who was sued by the RIAA for allegedly illegally copying and distributing copyrighted songs belonging to several music labels. The lawsuit was filed in a U.S. District Court in Boston in August 2007 after what the music labels claimed was more than 2 years of effort trying to get Tenenbaum to accept a settlement involving an undisclosed amount. The music labels claimed to have discovered more than 800 copyrighted songs stored in a shared folder in Tenenbaum's computer, although only 7 of those songs are specified in the case. Harvard Law School professor Charles Nesson this week filed a counterclaim on behalf of Tenenbaum, challenging both the constitutionality of the Digital Theft Deterrence and Copyright Damages Improvement Act of 1999 and the label's use of it against Tenenbaum. The claim is notable because it is broader than previous challenges related to the constitutionality of the RIAA's anti-piracy campaign. Nesson's move adds to the growing number of challenges being thrown at the RIAA's campaign from several quarters. most of the recent ones have focused on the industry group's use of a company called Media Century Inc. to gather evidence against alleged copyright violators. Several groups, including the Massachusetts State Police, Oregon's Attorney General, Central Michigan University, and Mount Pleasant, have called Media Century an unlicensed private investigator that is unlawfully collecting information on behalf of the RIAA. In his motion, Nesson argued that the statute was essentially a criminal statute and that it was unconstitutional to apply the law to prosecute a civil case in federal court, which is where previous RIAA lawsuits have been argued. He sought damages on behalf of Tenenbaum for what he claimed was the RIAA's abusive process in pursuing the case. He also challenged the constitutionality of the steep penalties for copyright violations that are provided under the Act. The penalties range from $750 to $30,000 per infringement, with a maximum of $150,000 for certain willful violations. Last year, Jamie Thomas was ordered to pay by a federal jury in Duluth, Minnesota, to pay $220,000 to six music companies for illegally downloading and sharing copyrighted music over a peer-to-peer network. Nesson argued that such fines are grossly excessive, you think, and far beyond the rational measure of any financial damage that might have been caused by Tenenbaum's alleged piracy. This is an unconstitutional delegation by Congress of excessive prosecutorial powers to private hands, Nesson wrote in his brief. The issues raised by Nesson are broader than previous challenges, which have tended to focus the constitutionality of the statutory fines provided under the Copyright Act. So this week's poll is Harvard versus the RIAA. And your choices are, I hope Harvard wins, I hope the RIAA wins, I don't care, I've never stolen music, I don't care, I'll just keep stealing music. What's the RIAA? And honey, they have music on computers now. So far, there are 44 votes, oddly enough. I hope Harvard wins. Seems to be in the lead. How interesting is that? Don't forget, when you're done voting, I know that just in this particular case, I know how how important it is for you to get in your 2 or 20 cents worth. So just simply clicking on a button is not going to be enough for you. Well, down at the bottom there, you'll see a little yellow box. If you click on Give Us Your Opinion, it takes you to my website, AskNick.com.
That's AskNick.com.
Ding. Thank you. And you can leave your opinion there while you're there. Check it out. I put out a newsletter. I have forums online. You can search all the old questions and answers and tips and tricks and rants and raves and interesting websites. And that alone is worth the $15 a year. So check it out. And then, of course, as always, join us back on Soundbites to hear what odd and unusual things our people are doing there as well.
I find it interesting on the RIA case that they found 800 songs, but they're only suing over seven. That means only seven of those 800 were from their member bands?
Could be. Or there's only seven they can actually prove had been downloaded through one of those services.
Well, that was the Jamie Thomas decision that got reversed on the first appeal.
Right.
The judge instructed the jury that they don't have to be downloaded, just existing is enough to make it illegal. And the appeals court said, no, that's not the way the law's written.
Right. Right. They have to prove it was downloaded. Because I've got thousands of songs on my machine, all copied from CDs I own.
Right.
Which, as I understand it, is at least quasi-legal at this point.
But if somebody copies it from your computer, they have an illegal copy.
Right. But just the fact that those songs exist on my computer,
if you allow someone to copy it, does that make you liable? And that's the tenuous part of the law.
Well, but what that first decision was is the simple fact that those exist on my computer makes them illegal.
Right.
And that's what the judge threw out. So I guess it's quasi-legal, at least, until there is... And you don't make law by omission. But apparently, at least so far, nobody has said it's illegal to make copies of your own CDs.
There are going to be a lot more lawyers getting a lot bigger houses over this before it's finished.
This is nothing but lawyer food.
Right.
Oh, yeah. This whole thing, nothing but lawyer food.
But poor artist, though.
He never got anything anyway.
Well, if they get a penny out of every album sold, that's a huge amount.
I've read books on how much the artists make from the record companies.
Yeah.
It's pathetic.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
In fact, that was the big irony when NBC pulled out of the iTunes store. Right now, on the iTunes store, your 99-cent... that you pay,
right?
The label gets 70%. So they get 70 cents, and then the copyright board gets another 10%, and the distribution, Akamai, gets about 10%. So Apple, if they're lucky, makes a nickel out of every dollar sold. NBC pulled out of iTunes because 70% wasn't enough. It's unconscionable that Apple won't raise our rates, was their quote.
Right, right.
And that's been the story for years. A typical record contract is 95% to the label, 5% to the artist.
Right.
And out of that 5%, they got to pay 50% to their,
well,
their,
that's
their people.
Right, right, right.
But the artists, though, you know, like you say, they're not counting on it, the actual record. What they're counting on is the tours and everything.
Right.
That's not part of the suit.
Yeah. So that's where a lot of the actual recording artists have figured out they can make up the money in the touring and the merchandising, not the actual.
Right, it's all about the merch these days.
Yeah.
The other thing, of course, is that a lot of the newer artists aren't even going with major labels. That, you know, the tough part right now for them is how do they get heard? How do they get known? But once they are heard, once they are known, they make a lot more money. So it's a gamble.
Yeah. That's always the joke. They want their music freely copied until they get the record deal, and then don't copy it, buy it.
Right, right, yeah. Right.
All right, let's take a question here from the mailbag. I got one in from Gina from Albion. Just wanted to know if you can recommend any secure or good software for converting DOCs to JPEG files. I'm hesitant to download some of the programs online. Thanks.
So she wants to convert a DOC to a JPG?
Yeah.
That what you can't.
Well, if you make a PDF, that's an image.
I was going to say, she might.
Well, take a screenshot of it. But a doc file by its nature is a text file, and you normally don't turn that into an image file.
Well, what I was going to suggest to her is literally go to OpenOffice. And in OpenOffice, she can take her document and just save it as a PDF with one commit, save as, or export, and it. Is it exported? Save
it's exported in OpenOffice.
Yeah.
Well, you can save as, but you can also export it.
Well, it also depends.
To make it PDF, you have to export
it.
And it depends on what she's trying to do with it. If she has doc files she wants someone else to read without purchasing Microsoft Word, that's the typical program that makes a .doc. And inside her own Microsoft Word, she can do a save as and save it as RTF or TXT, some generic format that other computers can read.
Well, if what a lot of people want to do, well, it really, you're right, it depends on what she wants to do, but generally people want to do what she's talking about in order to make it so that other people can't change the document.
And PDF would be
PDF
the best.
Does that.
A locked PDF would be the best way to do
if
that.
If it's a short enough document that fits on the screen, you can take a screenshot.
Well, now there's a great program. Matter of fact, I got my wife hooked on it, and she loves it. There's a program called Snagit. And you can literally do screenshots. You can select just areas. You can do scrolling. So if things literally scroll, you know, 7-8 pages down the screen, you can set Snagit to grab it all, and it will put it into a file, and you can save it as an image. And it will save the whole scrolled image that you can print off or do whatever you want. But again, because it's an image, you can't do anything with it.
Right. There's a similar program for the Mac called Snaps that does that. That extends on the built-in take a picture of the screen tools that are built in the Mac and
the
Windows.
Snagit, though, what I love about it is I've been using it for some of my teachings that I've been doing. I've been doing screenshots, and then with that, then you can add other things like arrows or added text. So you can highlight a certain thing that if you want, it's got a highlighter, you can highlight a certain area, put an arrow to it, and put an explanation of what you're trying to convey on this particular screenshot. It's a very useful program, and like I say, it's... I think if you buy it, because you get it for trial, I think it's like $20.
$50.
Is it 50?
From the company called TechSmith.
Also, if you've got something like OpenOffice, and you might be able to do this with pretty much any program that lets you create JPEGs, you can copy the document and then paste it into Paint or something else, and hopefully, you know, it'll paste it as text written inside a picture. But really, what's your name again? I completely missed it. Doesn't matter.
Gina.
Really,
from Albion.
Gina. What you really need to do, Gina, is to check out OpenOffice, because if what you're trying to do is make documents that are unchangeable, then making them as PDFs and locking that PDF, so when you go in OpenOffice, you say export as PDF, and you can click on the security tab and say restrict the permissions. So changes are not permitted, inserting and deleted are not permitted, whatever, whatever, not permitted, right? So you can make it so that all they can do is read and print it if you want. You can even prevent them from printing it, as a matter of fact. But beyond that, you can even set a password. So anybody who has the password can make a change. You can even encrypt it, so you have to have the password to open it. So she's there's a bunch of things you can do in OpenOffice.
And it's free.
And it's free. So if you download OpenOffice at openoffice.org, openoffice.org, and of course OpenOffice is all one word, there are no spaces in URLs. If you download OpenOffice and install it, it takes a while, it's a big program, but it gives you all of the features of Microsoft Office plus the database. So it's really the professional version of Microsoft Office, and it's free, oh, by the way. And it will save PDF documents, it will encrypt them, it will let you restrict permissions to whatever you want to do, and it's free. So give it a shot.
Yep. One thing we should mention again to folks, because I've been still getting emails, we will be on live November 16th. So you folks hearing this cast today on Sunday, November 2nd, we will be back on the air live just for November 16th until for that particular Sunday, and then it won't be again until after the first of the year. Because of the Buffalo Bills schedule, the 16th is the only open date. So, like we've been saying before, don't get upset. Don't get mad. Matter of fact, thank Jeff Hollett and the folks here at WHAM for still having us on here for this hour. You know, that we can still, you know, you can email us your questions and we can air them out here at least for 1 hour. They haven't totally just cut us off and said, you know, no, go away and see you guys in January. And that would have been, you know, all of September, October, November, and December. 4 months that, you know, we wouldn't have been getting any word to you. And on the same token, though, I'd like to thank all the folks that came into Second Life Friday night. That was a heck of a good time.
We had fun.
Even the big banana.
Yep. Pictures are up, by the way. If you go to our website, soundbites.org, and you click on, well, actually, it's right on the front page. You'll see the NSL sign right there in the middle. It says, join us in Second Life every Friday at 9 p.m. Check out our visitors list and our picture gallery. If you click on picture gallery, it will show you a list of all the dates that we've been in Second Life during. And they're listed by two-digit year, two-digit month, two-digit day, so that they fall correctly in order. Now, let me warn you. There are, particularly for Halloween, I took 77 pictures. So they are going to take a while to show up on your screen. If you're not on broadband,
even if you are, it's slow.
Even if you are, you want to you're going to want to make sure you've got a while before you open those pictures. But
is it worth the time invested, Nick?
It is well worth it.
Okay, then.
Well worth it.
We had a good time.
We had a great time. We had a contest.
Did you get killed, predicted?
No, I did not get killed.
Yeah, no, but I went. I wish
that's because Argyle wasn't there. And Bonnie weren't there, so I lived through that
Bonnie showed up. Bonnie was there at the end.
Oh, yeah, Bonnie was there at the end, but Argyle didn't show up, and Argyle would have killed me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I kept wanting to take a knife. You know, get like a dish. I wish I had been prepared. I would have had a dish with some, like, make it look like, you know, three scoops of ice cream.
Yeah.
And go after chasing after Nick with a knife because you need to, you know, bananas on a banana split.
For those of you who didn't make it Friday night, I was the dancing banana. I actually had a full dancing banana avatar and it danced.
That's all it did when you were standing up.
If I was sitting down, it was fine. If I was walking, I could walk. But when I stood still, it danced.
It was very funny. Full head off.
It was very funny.
Did you make that yourself?
No. I got that one online. And it was well worth it.
Okay, then.
Well worth it. It's pretty funny. Yeah, you got to look at the pictures because it really looks just like the dancing banana icon.
But Lolly coming in as the treasure chest.
She was a treasure chest with teeth.
Yep. Sit there in this treasure chest would open up and it's got all these teeth. I know another guy that creates avatars like that. He's got one that's a box.
Yeah.
And the box opens up halfway the lid. And it's got these teeth. And it spits things out. He's always spitting things out like buckets of Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Wow.
And all these other things. And he'll have it explode.
There were a number of great costumes.
Oh, yeah.
Newt Spawn. Was the little Spawn, the clown from Spawn, the evil clown from Spawn.
Kind of like Leguizamo.
John Leguizamo, exactly, in the movie, yeah. The best costume, I gotta say, Jack's List Scribe, he calls himself,
yep.
Showed up as, which clearly it's gotta be Jack Greenkey, it's Jack's List, right?
Yep. But
showed up burning.
From the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, it looked like the Human Torch. And he said, "What is that?" And he said, "I'm a Sony battery."
That was great. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Speaking of which,
that was item. Clearly was great.
Yeah, we won first place.
Captain America was there. There were just a bunch of great costumes.
Beachy showed up. She was
a witch on a broom. It was excellent.
Yep.
Who was the witch on a spider, or the spider witch?
Oh, that's Golda. She's a friend of mine from Dreams. She's always a rat, but she comes up with some great costumes. I mean, she makes a lot of it herself.
There were just a bunch of really excellent costumes. There were sword carriers and everything. That was just, there was a lot of good stuff.
I was the Invisible Man and nobody noticed me.
Alrighty then, we'll just move.
And one of the other ones,
just move right along.
One of those creatures, those other Lolly and
Predators.
Predators, thank you.
They were predators, and then Newt had an alien. She was an alien. She killed Eagle Wolf. There's a picture of that in there.
She's sitting there.
We needed to preserve that for posterity. Believe me,
she was strangling him good. I tell you what, let's take another question. We've got George from Henrietta, and George is running Windows XP with a gig. Clearing cookies and temps. Firefox 2. Well, that's part of his problem right there. And the security tangle, it states to clear out the temp files. In Foxfire, click on the tools menu, then click on options, then click on privacy. Click the clear button to the next cookies. However, in the version 2.0.0.17 that I am using, on the privacy page under the cookies, there is no clear button. How do I remove the temp files? Thanks, George. First off, George, I'd say go to 3.03, I think it is now.
And I do have to update.
Well, we need to update that page. And the other thing that I promise I will get done, hopefully this week, time permitting, is the updated recommendations list for a system.
Right. I only have the Mac version in front of me, and all three versions are different, which really kind of porks me off, but under tools, you can just clear private data.
Yeah, under tools, under cookie manager, under manage store cookies, there is a clear button. In Firefox, let's see, version 1.5, I'm on the wiki.
What is it Mozilla. For 3.0, though? Because I haven't...
Let's see, in Firefox 2, blocking cookies, where's clearing cookies? I'll post this link.
Okay. Because normally I just go into to clear out temps. Like I say, there's a tool that I've recommended for folks that cleans out everything. I wish I could. I'm having a
Firefox 1.5. It's under Tools, Options, Privacy, Cookies. There's a clear cookies now.
G's on 2.
And on Firefox 2 and 3, it's Tools, Options, Privacy, Show Cookies, Remove Cookies.
Oh, there you go.
So you have to show them, then you can remove
them. It changes
them.
With every version.
Yeah.
But like I said, there's another utility, and I'll get the name of that. But you can literally go in and with this one program, and it'll work with Firefox, clean out all your temp files, all your cookies, the cache, the whole 9 yards. And the other beauty of it is, you know how a lot of folks have, you know, 3 and 4 different users on their machine? It will clean them out for all the different users.
Oh, well, that's good then.
So I will get that to you, Steve, and you can post the link up there. I'll put a note to myself.
All right. And for the second time in 3 months, Microsoft again warned it would upgrade Windows Update, the service most users rely on to download patches and other fixes. Over the next couple of months, we'll be rolling out another infrastructure update to the Windows Update agent, said an unidentified Microsoft employee on the Windows Update team's official blog. This update makes it possible for users to install more than 80 updates at the same time. In other news, apparently Microsoft is looking forward to installing more than 80 updates to your machine next time around. According to a support document published Thursday's Windows Update Agent 7.2.6001.788 fixed a bug that produced an error when users tried to install 80 or more updates using either the Windows Update or Microsoft Update services. The last time I installed more than 80 updates, I was upgrading from one version of Ubuntu to another.
Actually, I end up running into that all the time. If you install XP SP2 on a clean machine, on the first check there's of 90, updates, there's 93 updates on the first check, and like 20, and then 20, and then 30, and then 40. It's like 200 updates you have to load on a fresh SP2 install.
And that's common in the Linux world as well, on a fresh install.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I can't wait to get my SP3 install disks.
Right. Microsoft last told users of an impending update for Windows Update in July when it announced an upgrade designed to improve scanning performance. The Windows Update process involves scanning the target PC to see if it requires any of the just-made-available patches. Friday's announcement and the one in July were in stark contrast to what happened last year when users raised a furor after discovering that Microsoft had updated the Windows Update client even when they had disabled the operating system's automatic installation option. Microsoft's response at the time was that it engaged in the practice before and that the client-side software needed to be updated no matter what the user settings in order to guarantee receipt of future security patches. So what they were answering was the mechanics of the thing rather than answering the charge that no matter what you set your machine to do, Microsoft will do whatever the hell they want anyway.
Right.
Yeah, well,
exactly. Because you don't own the machine, they do.
That's
well,
exactly
you own
right.
the machine,
they own the software.
So it looks like...
Subtle difference.
Exactly. So it looks like next month's monthly visitor will include more than 80
with which
updates.
I take issue.
Well, yep. Yeah, but, you know, I'm thinking, you know, a lot of these companies, Microsoft and the rest of them, and even I think you're going to see Frontier, with the way the economy's going right now, I think a lot of them, like, with Frontier and all that, putting the caps on the bands and everything else, I think they're going to back off from that. Because right now, they're trying to encourage folks to stay on DSL or Roadrunner. And given the economy and folks wondering, you know, granted, gas prices are coming down a little bit, but most folks are hurting. Because prices have gone up and their pay hasn't.
Right.
Just because the way the economy is, finally the government is admitting, oh, we're in a recession. And that's where I'm seeing a lot of folks using computers right now, doing a lot of updating and upgrading.
Right.
Just to keep their machine going for at least another year and see how the economy goes.
Right.
And if they start putting a cap on, you know, DSL or Roadrunner, I think you're going to see a lot of folks say, hell with it. I'm going back to dial-up. I can get it for $9.95 a month.
Right.
Because I can't afford it.
Right.
The budget just won't go there, and folks are just going to have to, they're making hard choices.
Yep. Speaking of which, recent sales numbers for Windows Vista paint a somewhat dreary picture for the operating system.
Good segue.
Thank you. As consumers and enterprises try to save dollars in an economic downturn, while Microsoft cited strong overall year-over-year growth in revenue in its fiscal Q1 2009 earnings report last week, the numbers for Windows Vista fell short of expectations, to put it mildly, with year-over-year growth of just 2%. The software giant expressed disappointment in Vista's lethargic sales growth, pointing to growth in inexpensive notebooks that use Windows XP or Linux and flat PC sales in developing countries as the two main culprits. Vista moved only slightly in a quarter that saw 10 to 12% growth in overall PC shipments. Meanwhile, Microsoft has been hyping Windows 7 while barely mentioning Vista at its annual professional developers conference in Los Angeles. Is Vista being unduly neglected, and is it too late for a significant turnaround? The answer is probably yes to both questions, according to Roger Kay, president of research and consulting firm Endpoint Technologies. Kay says that although Vista is getting a bad rap, it never generated enough momentum when it launched. It didn't make the big splash it should have in early 2007, and that window, so to speak, has pretty much closed, he said. Microsoft's claims that skyrocketing sales of cheap netbooks and flat foreign sales are Vista killers left many people unconvinced. Microsoft blames the low uptake of Vista on netbooks and foreign sales of less expensive versions of Vista. That is pure, 100% unadulterated BS, according to this guy. There are IT enterprise customers who wouldn't deploy Vista if their life depended on it. The real reason that Microsoft is sucking air on Vista sales is that the consumer market is drying up due to the economy, and the enterprise customers, even those with upgrade rights, are staying at Windows XP. Kay asserts that Microsoft is not hiding anything, and the netbooks and flat foreign sales are absolutely hurting Vista. But he added, Vista adoption has been at historically low rates. The learning curve is too great. The transition costs are too high for the perceived benefit. Meanwhile, Microsoft is greatly affected by the PC lifecycle. If customers delay purchases for financial reasons, as they're doing now, then fewer units go out, affecting license shipments. Add to that a higher proportion of discounted developing world licenses and XP Home and embedded licenses, and you have a recipe for slowing revenue growth. Microsoft, for its part, remains confident that Vista is building momentum, and it stresses that those who have deployed Vista, both of them, are satisfied. And we're seeing higher than ever Mac sales. We're seeing higher than ever Linux deployments. And all of that is hurting Microsoft pretty deeply.
As a matter of fact, just yesterday I participated in a local install fest for Linux.
Yep.
And met a whole bunch of wonderful people, reacquainted myself with some other great people. But it was amazing to a man and lady. They really were excited about getting a better operating system than the one they were using, which happened to be from Microsoft. Hey,
yep.
Live with the truth.
Go figure.
Go figure. That's a good way to put it. But these people were just besides themselves with not only keeping the old hardware working, but how well it worked. Yep. And the fact that they didn't have to continually reboot during the installs.
Well, yeah.
Which was a side benefit.
There was that. I've seen dozens and dozens of people take older machines that can't run Vista, that run XP slowly.
Right.
Then they're tired of constantly running the Tango and constantly having to fix things and constantly having to redo stuff. And anytime they want to do something, they have to buy new software. They're very, very happy with getting Linux on their machines, getting millions of free programs, and everything runs every day without a problem.
Mm-hmm. All day, every day.
They love it.
Like we were saying, what was it, a couple weeks ago, or in fact, I think it was just even last week, that in a long time, I hadn't heard this term, layaway.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, that states how worried the buyers and stores are that they're going to offer layaway in the hopes to get your dollars because they already know. I mean, Microsoft is like the government. They don't want to get their head out of the sand and realize that we're in a recession. Joe Public can already tell you that. You don't have to go to the government. You can just hear the people on the street tell you, yeah, we're in a recession, we're hurting. And, they can say what they want, but it is what it is, folks. And that's what Microsoft's got to wake up to the fact, too. People just can't afford constantly, and maybe in better times to just go out and get another system, that has 4 gig of memory, the highest end processor, great graphics, just to play goo. And that's all fluff. That's all Vista does.
Right.
And that's what we've been touting a long while. And like you said, the learning curve alone, it's just a pain in the butt. And then turn around and have a lot of your stuff not work.
Right.
Speaking of learning curve, at this Linux Fest yesterday, I was helping a number of people, and they needed to know how to do a particular thing. And I would lead them in the process of discovery, and they would say, oh, there it is. I see it now. It just makes sense. So even with the learning curve with Linux, because it makes so much sense, the curve is steep.
Well, it's like
shallow.
It's like buying a new car.
Yep.
You still know how to drive, you just don't know where the radio is. And 2 weeks after you buy that new car, you forget you didn't know where the radio was.
Right.
You still know how to compute, you just need to know where the menu choices are and what the programs are called. And that's really the only difference.
And to a man, they always knew what they wanted to do. They just needed to be shown where the button was, as you say.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
Okay,
right.
You want to take another question?
I don't know, do we?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we got a few here.
Well, I hate it when you ask me the hard ones.
All right. Peter from Fairport. It's IE and Firefox 3.0.3. I have some websites that I am instructed to use Internet Explorer to access, as they are not compatible with Firefox. The government ones do that. When I try to enter any of the site addresses in IE, for some of the reasons, Firefox pops up and loads that site. If I go back to IE, the address is no longer in the address bar, and the browser has returned to the home page. It almost appears that Firefox is hijacking my info from the IE browser and loading it into Firefox. Do you have any reasons why?
Yeah, there are a couple of things that could cause this. What's likely happening is that those IE sites are trying to run a program.
An external program to the browser.
External to the browser, and in order to do that, they are invoking a second instance of the browser. And when Firefox is your default browser, it opens up Firefox.
He's got to check to make sure Firefox isn't his default.
Well, Peter, the good news is that what's likely happening is that whatever those programs are trying to do to your system isn't being done because they're not running under IE anymore, so you win.
Good for you.
Good for you. So I'm not entirely certain that you want to stop that behavior.
Just try that address in Firefox directly and see if it works.
Right.
A lot of times we see these websites that say you have to use IE, and you don't. for a lot of different ways. You can use Firefox or Safari or Opera or OmniWeb or any of the dozen other web browsers there are. And each of the other browsers, there's actually, in Safari, it's called the Debug Manager. There's the User Agent, where you can have your Safari tell the other end, oh, no, I am Internet Explorer. And a lot of times that will work, too.
Right.
But if they are using an Internet Explorer-specific ActiveX control or something like that, or Microsoft Virtual Machine instead of the industry-standard Java, then there are certain sites that will only work in IE. Microsoft's update site is one of the specific ones, too. But, yeah, if that website is saying open a new browser window with this program in it, your default browser is set to Firefox, and so Firefox opens. For those specific sites, you may need to temporarily change your default browser to IE to run that. But just go ahead and try it in Firefox and see if it works.
The other thing you can do is there is an add-on to Firefox. If you go into Firefox and click on extensions or add-ons, you can get additional extensions and search for user agent. And it's called User Agent Switcher. It adds a menu and a toolbar button that lets you switch the user agent among different things. So you can be Firefox. You can pretend to be Internet Explorer 6, Internet Explorer 7, Netscape 4.8, Opera, whatever you want to be. So you can pretend to be that other thing. And therefore, when you're about to go to one of these sites, you change your user agent to Internet Explorer, and then Firefox will simply lie to the machine at the other end and say, oh, yeah, I'm Internet Explorer, all right. Yeah. Bring it on.
Yep. Dum-de-dum-de-dum. Lies.
No, exactly. Exactly. So that's a great thing because there are a lot of sites to check to see what browser you're running and simply refuse to run if you're not that browser. I get that all the time at work. Often that's simply lazy programming on the part of the programmers.
Yeah, very poor programming at the other end.
What they've done is they've used some Microsoft extensions, which made their lives a little easier, and therefore those extensions will only run under a Microsoft browser, or so you think.
Or even worse, they just don't care and say IE and don't bother checking it in any other browser.
Right. So definitely download the User Agent Switcher and let Firefox lie. It's okay. And this one time, you don't tell my daughter I said that, but this one time, it's okay to lie.
No one's going to get hurt by that kind of lie.
And speaking of no one getting hurt, another segue. And this definitely relates to Jack's costume. U.S. laptop sellers, including Dell, Hewlett Packard, and Toshiba, issued recalls Friday for defective batteries. According to the U.S., you didn't realize Jack was so timely, did you? According to the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission, the bulk of the bad batteries, around 32,000, are in HP laptops. Toshiba systems account for approximately 3,000 of the battery recalls, while only 150 Dell notebooks are affected. Another 65,000 batteries were sold or packaged with laptops sold outside the U.S. This laptop battery recall, prompted by reports of more than a dozen fires, including at least two injuries, does not affect Apple laptops, Sony confirmed. Apple's MacBook, MacBook Pro, and MacBook Air laptops are not affected by the recall, said Sony spokes individual Elizabeth Bulkus today. A Sony subsidiary, Sony Energy Devices Corporation, manufactured the batteries. The defective batteries are powered by the multiple 2.15-amp-hour lithium-ion cells and were manufactured between October 2004 and June 2005. Now, in 2006, Apple recalled 1.8 million Sony-made batteries. Those batteries, however, were powered by the 2.4-amp-hour and 2.6-amp-hour cells, according to the spokes individual who made an effort to differentiate Friday's recall from the one 2 years ago. It's a different recall, completely different batteries. Okay, they were all made by the same company, but come on.
Apple's now using lithium polymer batteries.
There you go. So when they do overheat, they'll kind of act like napalm because the polymer will stick to whatever it's being melted on.
It won't go flying up in the air. It'll just ooze on out and spread all over.
Exactly. The Consumer Product Safety Commission said that there have been 19 reports of bad batteries overheating. In 17 of those incidents, flames and fires were reported with property damage. In 10 cases, two consumers were burned in the fires, the agency said. So check it out. If you've got a Dell, HP or Toshiba laptop, you might want to check with your manufacturer or your vendor and see if that machine does in fact have the recall on it.
And again, I will tell folks and warn folks, if they don't think that's going to really happen, go to my website. It's nwritepc.com and you will see pictures of a laptop that literally caught on fire. And the poor gentleman was faced with a dilemma because he had gone out to the store, came back to the house. When he entered the door, he's looking down one end hallway, and there's smoke coming from his den. Meanwhile, the other end of the hallway is where his wife is, who, oh, by the way, is in bed on oxygen, and he's trying to determine which to do first, go put out the fire or try to get his wife out.
Right.
Got his wife out, but that battery literally caught the desk on fire. The fire department had to come. One whole corner of his room was burned.
Yep.
Because he didn't take the time. Oh, I never got around to it. Yeah, I know there was a recall. And, well, do you think they'll cover the laptop because now it's burned? I go, no. They told you months ago.
That's right. To go, if there's a recall and you ignore it, you're liable.
Yeah.
If anything happens. That's how that works.
Unless you can prove you never got notice.
Yeah.
Which is impossible.
Which is pretty much impossible.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Nowadays, it just ain't going to happen. Yeah. All right, let's do another one. This one is, this is a good one. And it comes from Mysterious Owl from Los Angeles, California. And he's going, the info here is Nexonic Wall Net Extender Windows Client Application version 2.1.56. Dear guys, since I downloaded this application from my company's website, I work remote, I have been hearing, you ready for this? An owl hoot. Almost every hour, and sometimes I think I disconnect from the NetX, and I don't hear it anymore. Do you think I'm being watched? Please advise. Thanks. Super.
He hears an owl hoot.
Does it say anything to him?
It's just the company is wiser than him?
Yeah.
My first thought would be, he set an hourly chime somehow.
Sonic Wall Net Extender Windows Client Application version 2.1.56. And since he downloaded this application from his company's website, so it's probably not infected because he works remote, keeps hearing an owl hoot.
I wonder if that's something to keep him notified that he's online.
I'm afraid I do not use that product, and consequently,
and by online I mean connected to his
still, I think he should still check
company computer.
Now I'm wondering if he should just check with the company to see if that's somebody in the IT department might know whether that's a feature that he can turn off.
Like I had a motherboard that used to play Für Elise from Beethoven whenever it overheated.
That's nice.
Well, what else would you play?
Yeah, this nice classical music was coming out of the other room, and what the heck is that? Well, I forgot to plug the fan in. So so the motherboard overheated and started playing Für Elise.
Nice. Honestly, that one I can't begin to answer. That's just one of those things where without...
He says it goes away if he stops the software, which is strange, because I might think there's an owl in his rafters.
Well, that's where I'm thinking he's got to check.
Maybe he literally has an owl.
You know, check with his IT department. There might be a feature in there that, you know, since he downloaded it from them, he doesn't want to go changing anything if he's got to work remotely without them.
Yeah, Owl is the name of one of the Sonic Wall softwares. Let me find out where it went to. Yeah, the Owl Internet Directory Access. So that's one of the programs that are built into the Sonic Wall software. So maybe it's trying to tell him something that this software is running and finding a problem, or this software is trying to tell him something.
Software's running and maybe it's telling him that somebody's trying to...
Yeah.
Infiltrate.
Or he's inactive. You know, maybe if it's sitting there and he's working on something else, it's really...
Well, it's only once an hour, I wouldn't think that would be inactive.
Mm.
Once an hour should be every minute. I'm off.
Yeah, right.
All this to say, we don't know.
Sorry.
We just don't have any idea.
Well, that's what I'm telling him. Go check with the ID.
That's a very, very good question, though.
Yeah.
It is an excellent question.
And we don't thank him for it.
That we can always get good answers, but
that's
we try. We'll be honest. We can't, we won't.
For those of you who have been following it, Google on Wednesday released a third beta version of Chrome. The browser introduced nearly 2 months ago to fix a single security vulnerability and address several other problems. Chrome 0.3.154.9 will be automatically pushed to current users, according to Mark Larson, the browser's product manager in a note posted to a Google blog on Wednesday. Users who had set Chrome to receive the more frequent developer updates have had most of the fixes and changes in 0.3.154.9 for some time, however. Larson characterized the one bug patch in the update as a medium threat and said the fix shut down an address spoofing flaw that attackers could use to trick users into thinking they were at a safe site when they're actually visiting a malicious or phishing URL. Also integrated into the update were several non-security fixes, as well as a number of design changes. Among the latter, a modification to the way the browser handles downloads of executable files. That change, although designed to block a months-old carpet bomb bug that could be exploited to dupe users into downloading and launching malware, was criticized last week by the security researcher who reported it to Google as a short-term fix only. The best solution was if they just don't download the files until the user approves, or download them to a random directory, as it's done with other browsers like Internet Explorer's temporary Internet Files folder or Firefox's random profile directory, according to Israeli researcher Aviv Raf. Google also modified Chrome's site indexing, which the browser uses to call up previously viewed URLs when users type search criteria in the address bar. We no longer store data from secure sites. They use HTTPS and show a lock in the address bar. You can still search your history for the site's address, but not the contents on the page. Google has been struggling to walk a line between usability and privacy. Shortly after it unveiled Chrome, Google was hammered by privacy advocates for recording every keystroke entered into the browser's address bar, then sending some users' data to its servers for examination. Bowing to pressure, Google said it would render those data anonymous within 24 hours. They're not actually taking... people have been talking about this all the time. I get a lot of questions about this. Google's not actually stealing your information. What they're doing is collecting metrics so that they can say to their advertisers, this is what people are searching for. Remember, at the other end, those of us who use things like Google AdWords and stuff like that want to know what people are searching for. We want to know what it is they're interested in. And those are the data that Google is collecting. Every time you type information into a Google search window, you're letting them know what you're interested in knowing about. So they collect those metrics. They don't collect them from you. They just collect them from the next person in line. It doesn't have anything to do with you per se. They don't know that Fred Smith is searching for cars. They know that somebody searched for cars. And when 150 million people are searching for cars, then they know that they can go to car people and say, look, 150 million people want cars. You pay us for ads and we'll put them up when they ask about cars. So it's not you specifically, but...
Well, that's sort of like Clear Channel here. Because folks have asked us, you know, why can't we stream the website, you know, over on Second Life? And it's because of the way WAM and Clear... Well, it's just Clear Channel policy. You've got to go through their JavaScript and opens up another window, then clicks on that particular URL. It's a way for them to gather information, count the clicks.
Who's listening? Because they have ads on their stream.
Yes, and they can sit there and say, all right, tell you what, if you, you know, advertise on our stream, here's how many hits we're getting, because folks, you know, are at work and are just listening to the radio on their computers. So your ads were going to hit this many folks during this time frame. So it's a great advertising tool for a lot of other companies, and they're utilizing it. And again, like you said, it's not stealing any personal information. All it's doing is counting clicks.
Right.
That somebody's going there, opening up that particular pane, and listening to WAM.
Which we recommend everyone to do.
Yep.
At least on Sundays.
Frequently and often.
Frequently and often.
Every Sunday.
Canonical Limited, the commercial backer of the Ubuntu Linux operating system, is not yet turning a profit. But founder Mark Shuttleworth said during a teleconference on Monday that he is prepared to bankroll the company for 3 to 5 more years. We continue to require investment, and I continue to be careful with my pennies in making those investments, but I consider this a good proposition, the billionaire technologist said. Canonical is not cash positive, but our offering is very attractive to those who want to pinch their pennies in the Linux space. The dismal economic climate could, in fact, drive more business for Ubuntu, Shuttleworth added optimistically. Canonical, which brings in money by providing fee-based services and support for the Ubuntu software, currently has annual revenue in the range of several million dollars. But the company's low revenue I don't think several million dollars is low revenue, but...
In the grand scheme of things, yeah.
Yeah, it is.
I bet you GM and Ford would love to be making that right now, but that's another issue.
Anything in the positive column, 48 cents in the positive column would do good. The company's low revenue and lack of profits hasn't shaken his belief in the business model. We are entering a time when there's a real commoditization of the desktop, so I don't think it would be possible to make a lot of money or even any money by trying to sell Linux itself, Shuttleworth said. The only way to build businesses around Linux is around services. Shuttleworth held a teleconference in conjunction with Friday's Ubuntu 8.10 release. Ubuntu 8.10 is out, ladies and gentlemen. Start your downloaders. Assuming you can, there were a couple of days. I downloaded it at about when it first came out, whatever
Thursday, right?
It was. No, Friday? No, it was Friday. Very early in the morning.
Okay.
Very late at night, very early in the morning. And I downloaded a copy to my machine, and it downloaded fine. But then I tried to download it again the next day, and it was
not happening.
Yeah,
speaking of which, OpenOffice 2.4.2 is out for Windows, at least.
3.0 is out.
Also, but
yeah.
They're also continuing to update the older version.
Right. But you want 3.0 because it includes updates for the DocX and XLSX.
Not to change the subject, but I was under the impression there were a lot of bug complaints against 3.0.
I haven't played enough with it yet.
Yeah, I've seen some.
Yes.
But I'm sticking with the 2.4 for now.
Yeah. But looking forward, Shuttleworth did hold a conference in conjunction with Friday's 8.10. 8.10 includes a whole bunch of things, including improved 3G wireless support, new features such as a guest capabilities that lets a user lend their PC to other people to check email and perform other tasks without disturbing the existing programs or settings or letting people into your system. So you can say, okay, for the next little while, a guest user is going to be using this account.
Mm-hmm.
It locks all your stuff. They can't get into it, but they could still run Firefox. They could still, you know, do what they need to do.
How does that differ from fast user switching?
Well, you don't have to set up a user. This is just guest user.
Oh,
and when
okay.
they go away, all their settings go away.
All right.
And then to get out of guest user setting, you have to put in your password.
Makes sense.
Cool.
Right. And your stuff is still there in the background, still running, because Linux is a multi-user, multitasking operating system. So under fast user switching, the other person's stuff stops running.
Right, okay. So this is an improvement.
Yeah, this is
a new feature,
very
I should say.
Yeah, it's very different. Pretty neat. Looking forward, Canonical expects Ubuntu's development to embrace three key trends, Shuttleworth said. Touch-based interactivity, 3D imagery, and the integration of web-like features into the desktop user interface. In the future, Shuttleworth said most devices will have a touch dimension within them, adding that the line between the 2D desktop and the 3D gaming environment are going to blur. What I really love, but one of the cool things about Linux, you want to talk about your eye candy? If you have a good video card, of course, if you have a gaming type system, you can have multiple desktops in Windows.
In Linux,
as opposed to the one desktop in Windows where everything has to run. So I can have one desktop with Google running on it, another desktop with my email, another desktop with whatever, and switch among them without having an overly crowded desktop.
Right.
Well, with the right hardware, you can then set those desktops around a cube or a dodecahedron or a... whatever. Well,
beware the power of the dodecahedron.
Beware the power. And then as you switch among them, the cube rotates from side to side so that you see what's going on. It is nothing but pure eye candy. Nothing but pure eye candy.
But I get that now.
But it is cool looking.
Because I've got the twin 22-inch monitors. And it's so cool because I can have so many windows open and it's just moving the mouse one from the other. Because normally, like when I'm doing up a quote, I can have my template open for the quote. I can have my spreadsheet that I do calculations with. I can have three different vendors, say, open. And I can go between all these different things and pulling bits and pieces as I'm compiling a system for a client.
Right.
Then it makes it so much easier than opening up this one. Oh, I got to minimize this one so I can see it decently.
Yep.
I'm loving it.
Yep.
And like you said, the different desktops can be a nice feature, though, for folks that don't have that.
Well, speaking of new computers for customers, we had a customer come in this week, and he's upgrading his 1996 vintage PC.
Upgrading?
Upgrading, yeah. He's running Windows 95 with Office
Got to be 95.
Four, no, the one. One, the one before 95.
Right.
And he wants a new PC, and we're trying to tell him that his files may not convert. Can Office 2007 read an Office 1 file? And
probably
if it can,
not.
Will it read it well?
You might want to try OpenOffice.
Yeah, so we're telling him, you know, OpenOffice or the Mac with NeoOffice or something like that. And he got really mad at us that we told him his files might not convert.
Right.
Because he's waited 11 years to upgrade.
He got mad for you telling him the truth.
Right. We do that, so I know Dave does that too. We won't sell him something just to sell him something if it's not going to serve their needs, or if what he wants to buy isn't exactly right. You know, so he's mad at us for saying that if he buys a new computer, he will have problems transferring his old files.
Right. The new OpenOffice, by the way, 3.0 runs natively on the Mac. You don't have to wait for NeoOffice. In addition, Microsoft on Thursday did release an update for Office for Mac 2008, bringing the most current version to 12.1.4. This update fixed a very specific problem that was caused by the last update. It addresses a calendar issue in versions of Microsoft Entourage that were updated with the Microsoft Office for 2008 for Mac 2.1.3. Update. The issue prevented Exchange accounts in Entourage from sending meeting invitations and responses. This can occur when an Entourage identity is configured with more than one email account. It's a 16 megabyte update. It's available at www.microsoft.com/mac/downloads.mspx.
And your Microsoft Auto updater should have probably already popped up by now.
Yeah, you would certainly think so.
You know, it's become almost the next national pastime to ridicule Windows and Microsoft in general.
Yeah.
But to be fair, every time we restart a Linux box, there's a couple of updates coming down too.
You don't even have to restart them. You know, there's updates all the time.
Right,
most of them don't require a restart. There's no question to that. There is no question to that. They all have their updates. But I prefer to get them when they're ready as opposed to having to wait for once a month. That's the part I don't like. It's not the number of updates or the fact that, of course, everybody has updates.
Well, you run enterprise machines, right, Lynn?
Right. Yes. We had an argument about that.
How do you manage your scheduling then?
Right. I make Dave do it.
Yeah.
One of my minions is named Dave, and he's the guy.
Yeah, if you don't know when the updates are coming, you can't plan for them. So Microsoft, because there have been people in the enterprise world asking Apple to schedule their updates.
Yeah.
And Apple says, well, no, we're going to release them as soon as they're ready.
Well, and it's two sides of the same argument. But now, poor Dave has to deal with 40, 50, 60 updates and do all the testing. And it takes the same amount of time. But now it's
once a month instead of every couple of days.
You know, it depends on which you like.
Yeah.
All right. We are done for another week. I want to thank everybody who wrote in. Please write in at soundbites.org, and we'll get to those questions. I want to thank Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Chris Reich, who ably comes in every single week and records the show, whether we want him to or not, and gives us his time and his talent and his efforts to do all of those things. I'm Nick Francesco. We want to thank you for listening. Remember, join us in Second Life Fridays and Sundays, and we will be back on the web next Sunday on the greatest computer show in the known universe, Soundbites on 1180 WHAM.
And we're clear.
Over and out.